I'm Riley Reese. This is the Sophia Unfiltered podcast, where we bring together thought leaders, wellness entrepreneurs, makers, and emerging health leaders. We're here to have raw, unfiltered conversations because sharing your stories has the power to change lives, help others heal, and transform the way we take care of ourselves. Here we go. Hi, everyone. We are super excited to introduce you to Dr. Monique Hureshkanazi. She's an award-winning academic scholar, a professor, a researcher, and clinical neuropsychometrician. Dr. Monique is an Air Force veteran and was a national security expert for over 21 years before transitioning to healthcare. She's now the owner of the Hureshkanazi Group, specializing in mental health care, research, and education. Welcome, Dr. Monique. It is so great to have you here, and it's always good to have another veteran on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm pretty sure our intro did not do you justice because you are such a world-renowned ex-security expert to mental health expert now. Where should we get started? Would you like to just jump in and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, initially, I was supposed to go to college, and I lived in West Virginia. That's where I grew up. And I seen an Air Force commercial approximately 3 weeks before I was to enter high school my senior year. And I just, you know, randomly called the recruiter at my nearest location. And he said, hey, come on down. It was a Saturday morning. And I ended up joining the Air Force like 4 hours later after we met. And so I didn't go to college. I went straight to the Air Force after I graduated. Didn't know that I would be in 13 years, but I started out doing web graphics and design and communications and knowledge operations. And then I ended up in security the latter part of my career. After being in national security for nearly, I would say about 17, 18 years, that's when I kind of crossed over into psychology. I became really interested in that, especially being deployed in Afghanistan. I seen like the levels of mental health issues going on when I was deployed, as well as coming back and noticing that my comrades were not the same when we came back home. So that's when I became really interested in psychology. And in 2018, which was about 3 years after I separated from the Air Force, I started working towards my master's degree in psychology. And here I am now in 2023. I managed to get a master's in psychology, my second doctorate, which is in clinical psychology with a specialization in forensic neuropsychopathology. And then I just graduated this year with a master's in clinical psychopharmacology. That's how my background led from national security to psychology and then specializing in neuropsychology. And now that's what I do for the last 3 years. I've been a neuropsychometrician in the clinical field.
Wow, that is just beyond impressive. And I'm pretty sure you love school.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually been teaching for the last 14 years. So I love to go to school. I love to teach. It's my thing.
Yeah, that's right. So you're also an associate professor now. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Initially, I started out as associate professor of Homeland and National Security. And then last year, I transitioned to associate professor of psychology. And my specialization is biopsychology and cognitive psychology at American Military University.
So I'm wondering, Monique, for the listener, what's a neuropsychometrician for the person that's like, what does she do on the daily?
So I'm a pre-licensed professional. That's what they call us, that we do not have our license to be a clinical psychologist. So as a psychometrician, what we do is we're scientists and we rate the testing. We look at the validity of testing. Some psychometricians, actually their job is developing tests and assessments and assessing the validity and doing those clinical trials, you know, to improve the validity of some assessments that are already out there, new additions, or creating new assessments and testing to be used to create establishment for not only neuropsychological, but psychological evaluation. So what I do as a neuropsychometrician, I'm not on that side of development, but I assess the validity of testing after testing has been completed between a psychometrist. And a psychometrist is someone who actually administers the testing, and they do check for validity too, and they score those assessments when we're doing evaluations for our patients. So what I do is I assess the validity I assess and analyze the results along with a clinical psychologist because they are licensed. So I'm supervised by a licensed psychologist. And together we go over the results and do report writing and then do the diagnosis for mental health conditions. So that's what I do. The neuro part is focusing more on the brain too, trying to assess how long-term severe mental illnesses impact the brain. So on the flip side, I do research in neuropsychology, but my conceptual framework is more focused on neuropsychopathology, which is how long-term illnesses impact the functioning of the brain.
I love that you're into testing. Testing gives me hives. I'm like, oh, I'm so glad there are people out there like you that are interested in that. How does long-term mental illness impact the brain? I know it's not an easy question to just answer, but giving us some idea of what goes on there.
Well, I'll try to give you the brief extended version, brief and extended way. So back in 2021, when I was working on my degree in psychology, my thesis was essentially on how OIF, which is Operation Enduring and Operation Iraqi Freedom. I assessed a time date of 2005 to 2016, and I did my thesis on how being deployed at the time of those timeframes, 2006 to 2016, how did it impact people who were exposed to trauma in combat? The results showed that at least 50% of the people who came back from deployment were diagnosed with either PTSD, a mild TBI, traumatic brain injury, or major depression. So when I went to complete my dissertation, I was actually doing this program simultaneously. I'm like, I want to further expound on this research and really see how it impacts the brain. So my research, which was actually published this year for my dissertation, I really focused on what was causing MTBI, what was causing the major depression, what was causing the PTSD, and it was linked not only to the combat exposure and the trauma as I discussed. The linkage was, too, that 50% of the people who came back, they were committing violent crimes. So it was trying to be determined in the military whether they would stay on active duty, because if cognitive functioning is an issue, they're not physically, mentally, or psychologically fit. So what I noticed with the data was those who committed the crimes, they were released from the military, whether it was medically boarded or whether it was for the crime they had committed. But it showed that the results from the longevity of severe mental illness, such as PTSD, major depression, and TBIs, that the frontal lobe was the part of the brain that was damaged. And that was assessed through what we call functional MRIs. The functional MRIs assess the activity within the brain. So it highlights what parts were activated during times of assessment of the functional MRI. So it showed that not only the frontal lobe, but the prefrontal cortex of the brain was actually altered. And with that assessment, it showed that reasoning, our executive functioning skills, such as how we plan, organize, prepare, you know, how we do our daily activities, it showed that those type of cognitive functioning skills were impacted. And when those type of skills are impacted, it sure, you know, affects the retention rates of the military, because if you're not cognitively fit, like I said, fit to fight, you're not physically, spiritually, or psychologically fit for service. So that's what my research showed in the results that was published this year. And I want to expound on those results too, because with brain functioning comes other illnesses too, whether it's medical or further neurological damage. And that's what I want to assess, because we've seen the severity of how long-term severe mental illnesses has impacted our military service members as well as our veterans.
Now, I got it kind of like a chicken or an egg question. Are these people that had pre-existing developmental trauma and that made them more at risk? Did they have a history of violence? Like, what happened to cause these people to act out violently, or did they have that propensity to do that in the first place? Or do you know?
That's a great question. And actually, I can't attest to that, because the research that I did review, it didn't give background information on service members or combat veterans that if they had pre-existing issues prior to, or if those pre-existing conditions exacerbated during service, or if they even had them at all. It was based on baseline assessment before deployment and then testing and analysis after deployment. With my experience being in the military, when I was in Afghanistan, when I came back from the military for 3 years, they assessed you. to see if you developed any, you know, the major ones too, PTSD or major depression or anxiety. They assessed me for 3 years. So I imagine it was a long-term assessment for anybody who went to combat, and it was mainly assessed on the baseline prior to deployment.
And is that self-report or is that neuropsych testing?
It's self-report for those who felt like they experienced major depression or any type of psychiatric condition after deployment, but the majority of it was mandatory as part of the regulations when you come back from combat that you go seek mental health so you can get assessed or screened.
So I want to get to blast injuries in just a minute. So we know that that obviously causes brain injury. But are you seeing that depression, PTSD symptoms, anything, anxiety, anything like that, are those causing structural changes in the brain? Are those causing things to change, or is it only blast?
So I didn't do too much research on the blast. I focused more on the diagnoses that was really correlated to PTSD, TBIs, and major depression. And yes, those were the cognitive changes that I was talking about with the prefrontal lobe and the frontal lobe as well. It caused those changes. And if it's not catched, it's something hard to really treat in the end, because the more the severity, the damage, the more difficult it is to manage those symptoms. That's why I feel like there should be more neuropsychological evaluations when coming back from deployments, and just instead of a psychological evaluation, because we're looking at the mental health, but we're not looking at the neurological indications too. So when I discuss neurological, I'm not just focusing on the brain. I'm also focusing on the nervous system too, because all those components affect people, especially when it comes to the severe mental health conditions, especially how having it long-term and the severity of those conditions, how can it impact the nervous system as well?
Yeah. So with neuropsychological testing, you can't really hide those deficits when you have them. You can't say, I'm fine, put me back in. I want to get back in the fight. And I know a lot of people want to get back in the fight. They want to get back to their battle buddies. They want to get back into combat, not really taking into account how much damage can occur, and that can be irreversible when you're exposed over and over and over again. And so what would the intervention be if you identified a service member that you saw that there was an impact on their neurological functioning or their neuropsychological functioning? What could be done to kind of mediate that?
From my experience of diagnosing actual military veterans, some of the recommendations that I did have was to you need to find you a neurologist and a team of a neurologist and a neuropsychologist working together, because that's what I find to be very important. There's components of what a neurologist can do that a neuropsychologist can't, and vice versa. So when I see deficits, especially with memory, it's like, please go see a neurologist and get a complete neurological examination. Once a neurologist, you know, rules out any type of medical, neurological, or other organic disorder, then they're referred to a neuropsychologist where they can do a comprehensive evaluation, just focusing on cognitive functioning. So that's what I usually recommend.
Yeah. So it sounds like early intervention is your best chance for restoring brain function, neurological function. And what are some things that you might recommend for brain health overall, just if you're noticing changes in memory or, you know, your decision making or planning, anything like that?
It might sound silly, and I know some people this won't work, but I do recommend apps that have cognitive functioning games. There's one, I think it's called Brain HQ. It's one that I even use, because as I age, sometimes I forget things or I have to remember a lot of things and it's difficult. So I use that app, and it's free, but if you want to do more and more games, you pay, like, I think it's a monthly fee, or you could pay a one-time fee. And it's just little games that improves your cognitive health overall. And it was developed by, I think, a neurologist or a psychiatrist. It was developed by one of those professionals who knows the facets of the complexities of the brain. And it's actually fun. It focuses on paying attention. You don't realize that you're really having fun, and it's not something like a job to do. But it's something that I recommend that you do at least twice a day. I do it the first thing when I wake up, and then before I go to bed, just kind of, you know, get that brain going and then get it to rest at night.
That's great. I know, as somebody that just passed their mid 40s, I'm really noticing, you know, my own memory and the cognitive function is not the same as in my 20s, and having a family history of dementia, it seems extra important to play those brain games. Is there any coming back from this once the damage has been done, or what hope is there for people once you notice like you do have deficits and maybe you did wait too long to get to the doctor? Is everything reversible? Neuroplasticity, how much can that account for recovery?
I would say it depends on the severity of the damage, and it also depends on how long it takes you to get seen for treatment. What we have seen is people who suffer TBIs or MTBIs, it's not just the military, it's other people playing sports or what have you. Early intervention is key. So doctors say, there's research out there that suggests that the first 6 months to 12 months are crucial. You will see any type of improvement during that time frame. And if you really don't see any difference or there is improvement and it plateaus, that's probably the baseline that you're going to have following any type of traumatic injury or anything that affects cognitive functioning. So that's why the early intervention is really important, because if you can get in as soon as it happens and you're working with a neuropsych team, I believe that, and the research suggests that there is improvement too. Some improvement, we're not going to say it's 100% because nothing's 100%, but if you get that early intervention, it's a higher chance that you might see some form of improvement when it comes to cognitive functioning.
And with somebody that has acted out violently and they do have some type of neurological deficit going on, that they were impacted, I'm curious, when it comes to the legal system, do judges take that into account when there's mental illness? And does that impact the sentencing or the how they're treated? Do they get treatment or do they get jail time?
I will say I have not focused on the civilian side. Preferably, it's been military justice system. It does play a factor. The research that, like I mentioned, that I conducted that was published earlier this summer, it showed that 13% were not held criminally liable for the violent acts they committed due to severe PTSD. That's what it was, severe PTSD and major depression. So they were not held criminally liable for their actions, the violent crimes committed, and they were sent to psychiatric institution for treatment rather than go to jail for their sentencing. So it's definitely, a factor. However, there's limited research on how much that does occur, because we're looking at retention rates, we're looking at people leaving the service and then staying within the military justice system too. It's lower than, dealing with these type of cases in the civilian sector where, the research and the statistical data would be a lot higher, more prevalent. But that was the research that I did find, and I find it significant because we are going to the way of looking at mental health as a serious condition and being considered when people are committing violent crimes. So we're headed that way. I think we just need to progress a little bit more, because as we've seen, crimes are being committed all the time. We just had a crime committed in the state of Maine where there was a National Guard member. It was known that he had mental health issues and he was hospitalized this summer. And we saw the atrocity he committed last week, the mass shootings. So that's where I want to go when it comes to the Department of Defense and Department of Veterans Affairs, really look at severe mental illness, increase our programs, initiatives, and awareness, and give people the proper treatment that they need because of these conditions.
So it sounds like instead of waiting for the atrocities to happen, you want to catch it early,
exactly.
Treat it early, and then we don't have to kind of do the cleanup afterwards of like, okay, now we've got a bunch of trauma out in the community and it spreads to other people like wildfire.
Right. Because there has to be some accountability. I'm not, trying to get political or anything, but when you read the article and you see that he was mentally ill, he was hospitalized and he was making threats, why were those threats not taken seriously? How was he able to still be out in the civilian sector and not hospitalized based on the severity of his condition? And those are the things that I look at. If they received the proper treatment, would that have happened? We don't know. However, we do know if he was still hospitalized at this moment, maybe it would not have happened. So with that said, it's like, again, preventative measures, interventions, early interventions to help military veterans and those who are suffering from mental illness. We don't want to use mental illness as an excuse for violent crime, but it's definitely, an indicator and something that's always involved. What we see now, there's some type of mental illness involved.
Yeah, I like that we don't use it as an excuse. But then when you look at the parts of the brain that are affected, really sometimes it's out of your control. It's like an impulse that can't be overcome. Like a child that can't control their impulses, we kind of revert back to that and we become a lot more dangerous, especially when we have access to lethal means.
Exactly. And then it goes back to neuropsychological evaluation. Sometimes it's the right place and time to do a neuropsychological evaluation than just a psychological evaluation. If a person has a long-term illness, now you need to see how that long-term illness is impacting the brain. So in the case of what happened in Maine, I would be curious to know if a neuropsychological evaluation was completed because it seemed like he had a long-term history of mental illness. Mental illness, even though it's treated, if they have episodes, if those episodes are exacerbated, if it's long-term issues that they're dealing with, it's highly likely that it's impacting the brain. So how about do a neuropsychological evaluation, establish a baseline to even determine if the brain is deteriorating, which is causing issues such as I'm hearing voices or I'm seeing things, I'm being told that I need to do this, killing people, you know, robbing people, instilling fear in people. Neurological conditionings really, really impact people's actions. That therefore, I'd be curious to know if one was done and to see if there was a baseline and how his brain was functioning at the time before the atrocities happened.
And Dr. Monique, I just want to circle back really fast. You mentioned that the long-term mental illnesses obviously impact the brain functioning and the nervous system, but you also mentioned there are short-term conditions as well. Can you tell our listeners, just give us some examples of the long-term that you're referring to and the short-term conditions that you're referring to?
So the long-term issues are PTSD, major depression, anxiety disorders. It all depends. Some people at some point in their lives have been depressed or anxious, right? But it all depends on how long you've been depressed or anxious, how long you've been dealing with it. If you can't come back to what we call your normal baseline of functioning, how it develops to be a disorder. So for example, let's say I'm anxious because of what happened last week, you know, the mass shootings. However, this week I'm fine. I'm back to my normal baseline. However, if I continue to be anxious, now I'm afraid to leave my house. Now I'm afraid to go out in public. And now this has turned into some physiological symptoms, increased heartbeat. You know, I feel nauseous. Anytime I walk out, I'm looking over my shoulder. I don't know if I can trust anybody around me. You're developing this anxiety. And when you can't stop worrying, when you can't stop having these symptoms, that's how a disorder develops over time. And there's time frames for each diagnosis, if you will. So that's what the difference between long-term and short-term, because any of them can be short-term. It's just how you deal with them. It's how you handle them. If you can't come back to your normal functioning and you continue to deal with them a certain amount of time and you meet certain criteria, that's when it becomes a disorder.
Okay. And you also mentioned that the depression and anxiety, these are actually changing our prefrontal cortex. The lobe, right? It's actually the anxiety that we're facing, the depression to PTSD and TBIs. I get that, but it's fundamentally changing the structure of our brain the longer we live in these
over
states.
Time.
Over time. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to get a picture of, you know, when, you know, for all the listeners out there who are, you know, trying to seek help, you know, it's like, at what point are you going to be able to say, you know, I'm experiencing XYZ symptoms and it's time to go see someone? And then who would you reach out to? You know, is that straight to a neurologist, psychologist? You know, what would they be looking at to seek help and what would they say?
What I find is getting a psychological or neuropsychological evaluation is almost like the last resort. Something will happen and the first thing people do is go to their doctors, right? Their general practitioner or primary care provider. If they can't medically assess anything, they automatically say, okay, you need to go see a psychologist because now that I see it's not medical, it might be something psychological. So usually what they'll do is like, okay, I'm going to get me a therapist. They'll get a therapist. They're diagnosed provisionally with something, but if the therapist finds that there's like therapy that they're working with the patient with is not working, that therapist will eventually like, okay, you need to be tested. I'm going to refer you for testing. And that's usually what I've seen happen in 3 years that I've been testing. That's usually how it goes. When I do my diagnostic interview, that's the first thing I do before they're tested to see why they're being tested and what appropriate measures they need. It's usually like, well, I was referred by my therapist. Well, initially I was referred by my doctor because I went A, B, and C was going on. Then they told me to go to a therapist. My therapist doesn't know how to help me because it seems like the treatment isn't working. So I want to definitively know what's going on with me. So that's why I'm here, to get assessed. And then they'll proceed me to tell what's going on, what they've been dealing with. And then I'll get a good idea of what they need to be tested for.
Yeah, that's great. So in all of this and finally getting to testing, I mean, it's probably frustrating for the individual to be dealing with, you know, going from physician to different practitioner just over and over and over throughout all of this. And now we have this knowing that we're actually changing the fundamental structure of our brain. And I think you spoke on this earlier, but is this impairment permanent that you're causing, even on these short-term conditions? You know, at what point can we come back from this? Can the brain recover from these long-term mental illnesses?
As I mentioned, it depends on the severity of the situation and if they're receiving the appropriate treatment. What you just asked, I want to bring something up because it just came to my mind. Essentially, some people may not know when they come see me for testing exactly what they need because they think it might be something and it's something else. For example, like last week, I had a patient and they're like, well, I don't really know what's going on, but I've been medicated for conditions I haven't been diagnosed for. It's just based on the criteria of symptoms that I met. And my psychiatrist said, hey, I'm going to give you these medications, but they're not really working. I really want to know what's going on with me. For example, they thought they had ADHD. Okay, well, with age, we know ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder that's found in children and teens. However, it can be found in adults if it's not treated as a kid. So I do get a lot of patients in the day that they're older and they are diagnosed with ADHD at an older age because they were not assessed when they were children. However, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is essentially how the brain functions differently than other people's when it comes to paying attention, being able, you know, to focus, to concentrate. And then there's some other components like hyperactivity, like the inability to sit still and just be hyperactive. What I find with certain patients, and in this particular example, sometimes there are other things that will cause something like ADHD mimic the same symptoms. For example, this person was tested, analyzed the results. This person didn't have ADHD. They had anxiety, depression, PTSD, because when you get in their background, you find out they've been exposed to trauma. They've been exposed to certain things that they have not been treated for. It happened when they were children, but now as adults, they don't realize that it affects them now. And when you're not dealing with things that have happened to you, yeah, it can be hard to focus, hard to concentrate, pay attention, feel like you have memory loss, or feel like your working memory is so bad that you just can't remember anything and you can't hold any information to be able to respond to somebody or complete a task. But a lot of people don't know, like anxiety, depression, PTSD, they can mimic other conditions. So when they come to me and they say, well, I think I have this, I have to do a comprehensive evaluation because I have to rule out certain things to ensure that I'm diagnosing correctly. So when it comes to that, like I said, early intervention is important because if you think you have something else, And you're answering your question, say this person has a neurological condition they think they do, memory loss, A, B, and C, meeting the criteria for some type of neuropsychological condition, but it's actually anxiety and depression because they have a fear of doing certain things that hasn't been treated and they haven't been going to therapy or getting treatment. No, it's not a neuropsychological condition. It's actually a severe case of anxiety. And if you get the appropriate treatment for it, it can be treated. And we know with treatment, there can be improvement of cognitive functioning. And I also suggest like sleeping, appropriate exercising, dieting, all these things play a role. It's not just doing cognitive skills and training to improve the brain. We all know if you have your adequate amount of sleep, you improve your functioning. If you don't have adequate sleep, you have a difficulty not only forming, but remembering new memories because you're not renewing your body, giving your brain time to rest and regenerate for the next day. So if you have long-term sleeping issues, it might seem like you have a neuropsychological condition. If you're not eating a healthy, balanced meal or exercising, we all know these things can impact cognitive functioning. So early intervention and doing multiple things, not just one thing, but getting your treatment, sleep, exercise, proper dieting, all these things can improve cognitive functioning over time.
Yes, a good night's sleep can really change the picture for a lot of people, myself included.
Yes.
I'm just curious, what are some of the barriers for our service members in getting the mental health assessment and treatment that they need? And then what would be your suggestions on how to work around that?
Okay. I feel like I can say this because I am a veteran. So I'm also a patient of the Department of Veterans Affairs, but honestly, it's the Department of the VA. Honestly, their system is so clogged up, it makes it very difficult for veterans to get the services that they need. And what I've found, especially living in the DC area, where we have a major medical hospital, it's still overbooked, understaffed. People can't get appointments for months. Staff psychologists, it's an insufficient amount of staff psychologists and medical professionals. Even me being a VA member and receiving medical benefits, they will refer me out a lot to civilian doctors because they just don't have enough VA doctors. And that's what I find with the veterans. They struggle just to get through the door to get that first appointment. So can you imagine trying to see a primary care provider to be referred to, you know, psychology? It's a long process. And sometimes it could take months up into a year for a person to get an appointment. And I find that such a disservice because there's people not only just serve this country, they're suffering. And maybe some veterans can't afford their own insurance. I have a secondary insurance because of the system, waiting 10 months just to get one appointment with my primary care provider because she's overwhelmed with so many other patients. I got my own insurance, but some people can't afford that. And what I said, I find that it's such a disservice because it's about treating the people who serve this country and giving them not even the minimum. They should be given quality benefits to the veterans so they can, you know, do what they need to do to improve their lives and continue to focus on themselves and their families. So that's one of the major things that I see with the veterans getting the proper medical services.
And so what should someone do if they find themselves in that position? Like, okay, I think I am ready to talk to a therapist. I'm ready to do it. And then they call and it's like, yeah, I could see you 8 months from now. What suggestion do you have? Like, what steps do they take to find that provider if they don't have a secondary insurance?
I would tell the veterans to contact patient advocacy. Every VA hospital or VA clinic in whichever state throughout the United States has patient advocacy. When I found that I had that trouble, that's where I went. And they do respond a lot faster when it comes to those type of situations. I would tell them contact patient advocacy, explain the problem of trying to get in and get an appointment. And either they will find some time for veterans to get in or refer services to where they can be referred out to civilian services to get faster service if they cannot find VA doctor availability.
Yeah, I love that, having an advocate to help you, because once you've reached that point, it's like you're lost in the sauce. It's like hard to make decisions. It's hard to know which way to go. So having that advocate can be so crucial.
Right. And it's not to down the VA system. It's like people need help. So if you don't get the help that you need, you have to advocate for yourself. You know, essentially do what you have to do, what's best for you and your family. So if you're not getting an appointment at a decent time, you need to advocate and make sure that you get what you need.
Dr. Monique, you state in your paper that forensic neuropsychopathology is the advanced healthcare initiative of the future, right? So where do you see this practice going, and how do you see this improving the quality of lives for those with mental health disorders?
That's a great question. So before I answer the question, I'd like to share that with forensic neuropsychopathology, that's actual conceptual framework that I developed working on the dissertation. So neuropsychopathology was termed before my existence, but it's funny, I could not find who coined that term. However, forensic neuropsychopathology is something that I found very important because we see an increased rate in crime and violence, and it's a criminal justice system issue, just like it's a military justice system. That's why I added forensic to neuropsychopathology, because I really want to study how the legal system, justice, fairness for people who commit crimes that are diagnosed with mental health conditions, you know, get the proper treatment. I believe that every person that commits a crime should not automatically go to prison. They should get the treatment that they need, especially those who are deteriorating. So I see it as an advanced initiative of the future, because the more we do research in this realm and emerge and provide more information in the, what I call a subdiscipline of clinical neuropsychology, the more we're going to have better treatment to be able to treat people who commit crimes. Right now, it doesn't look so positive, because what I see and what I read in comments and news articles, no matter what news platform it is, people are getting upset that mental health is an excuse to commit a crime. When a person commits a crime and they're caught, now they have a mental health illness, and it's getting to a point where I believe American citizens are not believing that everybody has a mental health issue. And that's also probably not the case. However, I don't want mental health to be downplayed to a part where a person's really suffering, committed a crime, and now they're being held accountable. I mean, where's the right and justice for that? So that's why I find the more research that we do in this new emerging framework, the more we're going to better understand the relationship between criminal justice and neuropsychology.
Well, Dr. Monique, we appreciate you being here and spending your time with us today. And before you go, we have a question that we ask all of our guests on the show. Can you please share three fundamental pillars that contribute to your well-being?
So, yes, the first important one for me is the self-care. I don't practice it consistently like I should, but more often than not. But the things that I mentioned before, like the rest, exercising, dieting, making sure that I'm living a healthy life, is really important. And that's something that I realize when I don't do, I don't feel my best. So that's when I get back on the game and I make sure that I put myself first, because if I don't, how can I be a good clinician for my patients? How can I be a good professor to my students? So that comes first. Second, military and mental health to me go together side by side. And it's something that I realized when I was on active duty. And I feel like even though I'm not in the military anymore, it's my job and my duty to help those that are still on active duty, as well as the veterans that have served, to help them and their families. So those are one of the things that are really important to me. And that's something that I will strive to do until the day I die, is to help my brothers and sisters. And thirdly, my mentor was definitely an inspiration. For those who don't know, Dr. Ashton Carter used to be the Deputy Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Defense for the Pentagon, Department of Defense, and he passed away a year ago on October 24th. He was definitely a mentor to me in every aspect. He's the reason why I'm a doctor today, and he's one that really pushed me to move forward and really think outside the box and really expand my horizons, because he believed in me before I believed in myself, being a young 28-year-old at the time, telling me that, you know, I could be a doctor. And the moment that I enrolled in my doctoral program, he never called me by my rank again. He called me doctor, and he spoke it into existence.
Wow. Just seeing the ripple effect his beautiful life has had, honoring him. So, Dr. Haresh Kanazi, where can our listeners find you if they'd like to connect with you? And I know that they will.
So you can find me on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/Haresh Kanazi, or X at twitter.com/Haresh Kanazi. Also have my website at www.thehareshkanazigroup.com. So if you click on the info at thehareshkanazigroup.com email address on the website, you can catch me there too.
Great. And we will link to all of that in the show notes so people can connect with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us and sharing your wisdom with our listeners today.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yes, we hope we get to help many veterans with this call, and those who are out there in that waiting period, we hope that they can reach out to their patient advocates for those veterans in the system that can't get their appointments. Anything that we can do to expedite the care and get people the help that they need. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. This has been Sophia Unfiltered, a podcast by Sophia Health, the number one marketplace for health and wellness. Find services, classes, and products from the top health and wellness providers. Book an appointment or join live classes now. I'm your host, Riley Reese. If this episode resonated with you, we'd love to hear about it in the comments section of your favorite podcast provider or with a 5-star rating. Let us know what your biggest takeaway from this episode was, or share it with someone you hope to inspire. Join us again next time for more real conversations, stories, and insights that help empower you with the knowledge and inspiration needed to transform how we care for ourselves.